Let me tell you about something new.
It's time.
A new show called G's Power.
G's Power.
Real talk for real saints.
Are you ready?
And it's for real.
Welcome to G's Power Hour, live every weekday at 11:30 a.m. on Never Had It So Good Entertainment Network. Your host, G, will bring you informative and entertaining guests and a variety of topics in a way that you can absorb and enjoy. Listen in weekdays and call in at 516-387-1944. We love interaction. All shows can be downloaded if you miss one or found on iTunes the next day. G's Power Hour is powered by Never Had It So Good Sports Media Network.
G's Power Hour.
Yeah.
Well, good morning, brothers and sisters, kings and queens, angels and saints, ladies and gentlemen. TGIS, and welcome to G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. I am your host, G. Thanks so much for being with us today. Yes, I'm live today. It's been a crazy week, but I'm glad to be here with you all and hope everybody's well and getting ready for a wonderful weekend. And, you know, I've been harping on you about all of the needing to register the votes. I hope that you all did register to vote. And you are preparing, looking over your sample ballots or absentee ballots and going online and looking up people, as I've recommended before, judges and whatnot. But there's another component. There are other components other than just registering to vote in order to make your voice heard. And we're going to talk about one of those for the first half hour this morning. We are here talking about lobbying with Mr. Brendan Quinn. Good morning. How are you doing, sir?
Hello. Good morning. I'm doing quite well. Enjoying this. I'm up in D.C., so I'm enjoying a lovely fall morning right now.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. Temperature's probably much different than it is down here in Florida.
Probably a little bit colder, yeah.
Okay. So now, Brendan, the reason I asked Brendan to be on, he's with the Center for Responsive Politics, and they kind of have a finger on the pulse of what lobbying is all about. But first, before we go into that, tell us what the Center for Responsive Politics is.
Yeah, so the Center for Responsive Politics, also known as Open Secrets, we are a nonpartisan nonprofit focused on transparency in the world of money and politics, and that includes three components, as you said: lobbying, but also campaign finance and the personal finances of our elected officials. And we try to make mostly public disclosures that already exist more readable to the public who don't know how to navigate really, really complicated spreadsheets and disclosure forms, but also make sure that there is transparency in all areas of the ways that money could be influencing our politics and our elected officials.
Okay, so how long has the center been operative now, and how did it start?
Yeah, so we were actually founded by two retiring members of the Senate in 1983. So we've been around for quite a while. We have since become a lot more publicly accessible with, you know, the invention of the Internet. Since the 1996 election cycle, we've been operating opensecrets.org, which makes all of our information available to the public. But really, we were founded in the early 80s with the mission of adding more transparency, originally to campaign finance, and then the world of money and politics in general.
Okay. So tell me about how the impact of lobbying, basically, because like I said, we do focus a lot on, you know, register to vote, and that is primary, that's key, that's crucial, but lobbying is important too. And I know some people don't like to get kind of entrenched in that because they hear different things. So I want to talk about what lobbying actually is and what is responsible lobbying and what is irresponsible lobbying.
Absolutely. So lobbying is kind of the other side of the coin to campaign finance, where campaign finance is money that is being spent to influence voters and influence who gets into certain offices and wins seats. Lobbying happens afterward. Lobbying is activities that are spent to influence public policy being created and how those members of Congress or anyone who's sitting in any publicly either elected office or appointed office votes or crafts legislation. So I like to think about hiring a lobbyist the same way that someone would think about hiring a lawyer. You're hiring someone to advocate on your behalf in the public sphere. So you can hire a lobbyist, and almost anyone who wants to can hire a lobbyist. If you're a small business owner, you can hire lobbyists to represent you. If you're a Fortune 500 company, you're probably going to have in-house lobbyists, like the way that you'd have in-house lawyers. But you can also hire someone from a lobbying firm, the same way you'd hire someone from a law firm to represent your interests. And those people are going to go to your elected officials. Our focus is on the federal level, but there are lobbyists that operate at the state and local level as well. And you're going to hire these lobbyists to represent whatever you want to be represented to those elected officials. This can be either in favor of or against a bill, or simply to provide expertise, saying, you know, we are an environmental group. We want this lobbyist to represent two members of Congress who are crafting an environmental bill, the sort of impact that this bill would have on the environment, if that makes sense.
Now, PACs are the key component in terms of lobbying sometimes. Can you talk a little bit about what a PAC is?
Yes.
And the impact of PACs and what well-known PACs there are. I happen to kind of be it has a strong PAC, but go ahead.
Yeah, when we're talking about PACs in this sense, for those of you that don't know, PAC stands for Political Action Committee. We're mostly talking about corporate or ideological PACs that are going to be attached to whatever group or corporation the lobbyist is representing. So these political action committees can raise up to $5,000 from any individual. In most cases, we're talking about an ideological PAC or a corporate PAC. They're going to be individuals that are giving to it are going to be affiliated with that ideological group or corporation, but really they can come from anybody. And those PACs can then give up to $5,000 directly to a candidate's campaign, and they can actually do that twice in an election cycle, once in the primary election, and then once again in the general election. So one thing that can come hand in hand when a lobbyist visits a politician's office, whether it is a local politician or a member of the House or the president, they can say, all right, well, you know, we're going along with this bill. This is the way that we're feeling about this bill. And oftentimes that lobbyist is also the person who controls that corporation or that ideological group's PAC. And oftentimes when a politician goes the way that a lobbyist is advocating for, that can often lead to a contribution from that corporate PAC, if that makes sense.
Okay, so stayed away from them a little bit, but I got involved in one of my Realtor Association committees that has the responsibility of dealing with the PAC for the realtors, which is one of the most powerful. Not trying to toot horns or anything, but it is kind of one of the most powerful lobbies out there.
Real estate is an extremely powerful lobbying group up there with things like the pharmaceutical sector and other sort of financial sectors other than real estate.
Okay. Can a PAC or any type of lobbying group be too strong where it overshadows the needs of the many, so to speak?
I'll talk about PACs first and then talk about large lobbying presence. The thing about one of these traditional PACs that we're talking about that's going to be attached to an ideological or corporate group is the max they can give to a candidate in a whole election cycle is $10,000. So in the grand scheme of things, we're predicting that this election is going to cost over $10.8 billion when all is said and done, possibly more, possibly surpassed $11 billion. $10,000 is not that huge in the grand scheme of things. So a group that can only afford to give $15,000 is not that much less powerful than a group that can afford to give millions, because they're limited by those campaign contribution limits. But when we're talking about the amount that you can spend on lobbying, there's a lot less of a limit on that. And yes, a group that is far wealthier can afford to spend quite a bit more money, so they can afford more lobbyists, they can afford more expensive lobbyists. If they're not based in D.C. or their lobbyists are not based in D.C., they can afford to send their lobbyists to D.C. on more trips. You know, if you're a local group in Florida or in California or anywhere else in the country and you don't have that much money, it's a lot harder to spend money to just get in the same room as the politicians who are going to be spending, who are going to not, excuse me, spending, not who are going to be voting on this bill. And so there's just so many more barriers to people who can't afford to spend that much money.
So now, of the groups that we may be familiar with or may not be familiar with, what groups do you all find the most effective and why?
Well, as opposed to going into individual groups, it's okay. Really just going to be whoever can spend the most amount of money is going to be the most effective, because they can hire more lobbyists, they can hire the best lobbyists. Again, for people that are unfamiliar with lobbying, I like to, again, equate it to hiring a lawyer. If you are a very, very wealthy individual and you need to hire a lawyer, you can hire a big firm, you can hire a massive legal team of like 4, 5, 6 lawyers, each of whom is making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year and has fancy degrees and everything, and can put all of their expertise on your behalf, as opposed to somebody who is hiring, you know, a less expensive lawyer who might have less money and is going to have a harder time getting their voice heard.
Okay. I see. So fundraising is apparently is the big issue then, just trying to be effective. Are there, let's say, more effective fundraising strategies than others?
For a politician?
Yes, for a politician, for a lobbying group.
Well, a lobbying group is not really going to be as attached to the fundraising as much.
Okay.
Because as I said before, I would say that lobbying is really usually money spent that is after an election that is going towards influencing. You know, you're paying a lobbyist to influence or provide expertise to someone who is already elected, whereas campaign finance is going to be the money spent to get someone elected, or in some cases to prevent someone from getting elected.
Okay. So someone who may be interested in taking on a job as a full-time lobbyist, what would be the unique qualifications for that job, and what is that? Do you have an idea of a pay range for something like that?
There really isn't a way to gauge the pay range, simply because there's a wide variety of people who serve as lobbyists. So you are required to register as a federal lobbyist if you spend more than 20% of your time on lobbying activities. And that's really going to be a self-definition. Like, you have to file with either with the Secretary of the Senate to file all of that information in, or the House clerk. You can file with either. Even if you're lobbying the White House or the EPA or the Department of Education, for example, you're still going to be lobbying. You're still going to be registering with Congress. So in many cases for corporate lobbyists, it's going to be people like the VP of outreach for an organization or something like that. Their title isn't always lobbyist. And sometimes it's going to be somebody who it's only a small portion of their job. And you could also be someone who is what we'd call a citizen lobbyist, who you're doing this outside of your normal job. And that's usually going to be somebody representing an ideological interest, advocating for something that they believe in and care about, rather than someone who's doing it as part of their job. So lobbying, there isn't a special qualification. You don't have to have a degree in really anything in order to technically qualify as someone who is a lobbyist.
Okay. We're going to take a quick break. We are here with Brendan Quinn. He is with the outreach. He is the outreach and social media manager for the Center for Responsive Politics. The number, if you have questions for Brendan, is 516-1944. This is G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment, and we will be right back.
This is Douglas Dobbs of Dobbs Cremation and Funeral Service. We have served the Central Florida community for 29 years with quality funeral and cremation services. Honoring all religions and faiths, we have been here for many grieving families. Whether it's a complete funeral service with a burial or a simple, dignified cremation, Dobbs Cremation and Funeral Service is here for you. Located at 430 North Kirkman Road at the 408 Expressway, Dobbs Cremation and Funeral Service, 407-578-7720. Dobbs, dedicated to serving our families.
Over the past 60 years, Dove Beauty Bar's superior formula has remained unchanged. But when it comes to beauty, everything changed. Together, we redefined beauty. We said no to stereotypes and yes to every type. We let go of judgments and embraced what makes us unique. We're proud to have been there with you, caring for you every step of the way. Here's to the next 60 years.
Good morning and welcome back to G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. I am your host, G. Thanks so much for being with us today. We are here with Brendan Quinn, and we are talking about lobbying. And I wanted to ask you about the concerns of the center with regards to this year's election and political activities. Because it's an unusual year. I think it was going to be a little bit unusual anyway, but it's because of COVID, it's definitely gotten a little bit crazier. But can you talk a little bit about what's been going on? Hello, Mr. Quinn?
Yes, hello. Sorry, I accidentally leaned on my mute button.
That's okay.
So we are about a month away from Election Day, and the 2020 election is already the most expensive election of all time, and that's only going to go up as things get closer to Election Day. Campaigns tend to spend more in the final 3 weeks, that final stretch up to Election Day, as they have their final chance to influence voters, especially because that's the time that voters really start thinking about who they're going to vote for if they haven't made up their minds already. This week, we saw the North Carolina Senate race become the most expensive congressional race of all time in terms of outside spending, that spending by super PACs and other outside groups. And we're expecting more and more milestones to be passed as we get closer to Election Day. Like, even if everybody stopped spending last week, it would already be the most expensive election ever.
So let me ask you this. Is it strategic, this additional spending, or is there a COVID-induced panic along with this additional spending that's happening?
Well, I would say that especially candidates, but also outside groups as well, are able to spend more because of an increase in giving. We're seeing a massive increase in giving, especially by small donors, people who give $200 or less, going to everyone, like across the board, grassroots giving is really, really ramping up this election cycle. We saw it in 2018, and we saw it increase even more this election cycle. So because they have more money, they are able to spend more and spend it in a wider range of places. You know, if Joe Biden didn't have as much money as he did, he wouldn't be able to spend money in red-leaning states like Texas that he now has a chance of winning because he is able to spend so much more money in that space. And a big component that is fueling this increase, especially for small donors, those people who are giving $200 or less, is the ability to give online. You have fundraising conduits that allow candidates to raise money through their websites, something that would have been unheard of 15 years ago. And now if you're in Florida, you can see a candidate that you like in Arizona, in Montana, and say, hey, I really like that candidate. I can give the money. And from your smartphone, from your computer, from the comfort of your own home, you're able to give them a campaign contribution, which is another thing that is fueling this massive increase in candidate spending.
That is so interesting that you say that, because I have received mail or contacts from people outside of the state. And I'm like, I don't know who you are. Why are you asking me for money? But I hadn't really thought about it that way. And I guess with everybody working from home and becoming more familiar with the technology and using it more often, that's made other candidates more accessible and causes more accessible where people give now.
Yeah, especially with people who have viral videos. You know, where this happened a bit in 2018 and a bit this cycle, where a candidate will have, you know, a video that's on YouTube that you don't even have to pay to distribute videos on YouTube. You can just upload them to your personal page, and they go viral.
Wow, that's amazing. That has really changed the whole landscape of campaigning right now. So.
Oh, absolutely, especially with technology allowing, you know, not just these small donors, but they're able to interact with their big donors from coast to coast through virtual fundraisers on Zoom or what have you, that, again, this technology would have been unthinkable during the 2000 presidential election.
Wow, that's crazy. That's crazy.
Yeah.
So, I was listening to what you were saying about Vice President Biden in Texas. So in terms of the smaller donors giving, is that having a better impact on the Democrats versus the Republicans? And then also, what about independents or other smaller, lesser-known parties?
Sure. So by and large, the small donor giving is helping Democrats more than Republicans. But if we're talking about the presidential race, Donald Trump is actually doing astoundingly well with small donors. They're providing just about half. The number changes as we get different disclosures from him. They have to file on a monthly basis. But he's hovered around the 50% range in terms of small donor giving. That means people giving $200 or less are providing half of the funds for his campaign, which is really just astounding when you think of how many people giving to that campaign that is. So one thing that we say is that small donors and a massive amount of small donors giving to your campaign, why we think that's a good sign, is it's a symbol of grassroots enthusiasm. If you're getting all of your checks from a small amount of people giving the maximum campaign contribution of $2,800, that's less voters who can go to the polls and vote for you than if you're getting that same amount of money, but from a wider range of people who are each giving $5, $10, $15, because that means that there are more people giving to you who aren't guaranteed votes, but seem enthusiastic enough about your campaign to give to you.
Okay. So, wow. You know, like I said, I wanted people to know what other influences are out there other than just registering the vote and going to the polls, and how important lobbying and other related activities are. So how do people get in contact with the Center for Responsive Politics or get involved?
Sure. Well, you can check out our website, opensecrets.org. We're on most social media platforms. You can follow what we're putting out there. We have a fantastic team of journalists who are putting out stories based on money and politics data to make sure that people are best informed about lobbying, about campaign finance, about the personal finances of our elected officials, and making sure that people are aware of what's going on.
Do you happen to know if there are any, let's say, workshops or seminars or anything that are given for the public so that they can be more educated on this?
So we do occasionally hold webinars. We don't have any scheduled right now for the imminent future, simply because we're so busy trying to gear up for the election. But there are a number of active groups that teach people about this sort of stuff, and we're always available. We have an active chat bot on our site that people can ask questions to, and that We've helped has been very helpful with directly interacting with the public. And they can use our resources, and if they're interested in something at the state or local level, they can check out followthemoney.org. They're like a friendly organization to us that they operate on the state and local level, and we have the data on the federal level.
Okay. All right. And you said gearing up. What does that entail for you guys?
More coverage of what's going on with the election. As we get closer to the election, there are more filing deadlines for candidates. So they have to file, rather than presidential candidates filing on a monthly basis and congressional candidates filing on a quarterly basis, they have to file their pre-election reports, too, at varying points in the couple weeks leading up to the election so that we can get a better picture of how much money they've raised and spent heading into the final weeks of the election. And there's also just going to be more outside groups popping up and spending money that we're going to have to be trying to keep track of as best we can.
And then what happens to you guys in the in-between time or downtime?
There is no in-between time or downtime. Because in the weeks after the election, we're getting post-election reports and people are filing reports detailing how much money they spent in the immediate days leading up to the election. And then we're tabulating just how much money was spent overall over the entire two-year election cycle, because the 2020 election cycle started on January 1st, 2019. And then before we know it, the beginning of the 2022 election cycle beginning on January 1st, 2021. Depending on who wins the presidential election, there will be more work for us to do. If President Trump wins re-election, there's certainly going to be some people leaving his administration and people coming back in. We're going to try to keep track of who they are, because many of them will certainly have either financial ties to the private sector or they will have worked in the private sector. And it's interesting to see what interests are cycling in. And that's going to be exponentially more work if Joe Biden wins the election, because there's going to be a changeover of every department and every job in the White House. And we're going to be trying to keep track of who those people are that are going into the White House. That's where a lot of our personal finances research comes in, and also a lot of our lobbying research, because many of the people who are working currently in the Trump administration and are likely to be working in the Biden administration have history of working as a lobbyist at some point.
And then what I also wanted to know before we go is the nomination of Judge Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court.
Yes.
Do you all – what kind of – are there any, I guess, outside forces that could impact the decision on whether or not her nomination –
Absolutely. Absolutely. So there are a number of outside groups that would be spending – in order to influence people on this, because we're so close to an election where a number of senators who can sway the balance of this vote for a Supreme Court justice are up for re-election and in danger of losing their seats, a lot of groups are spending on ads that would be influencing the voters in those states, in places like Lindsey Graham's state of South Carolina, or Tom Tillis' state of North Carolina, or Martha McSally's state of Arizona, or Susan Collins, who very famously voted for Brett Kavanaugh and launched a major outcry in 2018, her state of Maine. A lot of these outside groups that were already spending in Senate races massively ramped up their spending with ads focused on the Supreme Court race, saying, hey, you know, if this senator votes the way that you don't want them to, there's another option. You should vote for this other person. And there are a number of judicial-focused, what we'd call dark money groups. And when we say dark money, we're referring to a political nonprofit that is allowed to spend on influence without disclosing who its donors are, that focus specifically on judicial races and on efforts to influence senators' votes when it comes to the Supreme Court and other judicial votes. and those are on both sides of the aisle, and they've planned to spend tens of millions of dollars on this sort of influence.
Wow. Mr. Brendan Quinn, thank you so much for the time today. I wish we had a little bit more, but I appreciate you touching on this, and I'm hope to have you back at some point. And
Absolutely.
Best wishes on your efforts, and stay strong, because it sounds like a very tiresome job, but sounds like it's very fulfilling. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Of course. Have a good rest of your day.
Have a blessed weekend. Thank you. When we come back, we're going to talk about domestic terrorism and who tried to kidnap Gretchen. Not me. Okay. This is G's Power Hour. I've never had it so good entertainment, and we will be right back.
Having a wedding, reception, family reunion, planning a banquet, or some other fundraising event. Need to share your knowledge through a workshop or seminar. Or it's a difficult time, and you need to plan a wake or repast. Let us help. At our gatherings, let us reduce the stress and make the occasion memorable, treasured. Call our gatherings at 407-968-9387 or email ourgatherings@yahoo.com. Let us help plan your special event.
This is Douglas Dobbs, owner and funeral director at Dobbs Cremation and Funeral Service. We have served the Central Florida community with two generations of family funeral service. With the recent addition of my son Brandon, we are here to take care of the needs of Central and West Orlando. From simple cremation to a full burial, Dobbs Cremation and Funeral Service is here to help you. Located at 430 North Kirkman Road at the 408 Expressway, Dobbs Cremation and Funeral Service, 407-578-7720. Dobbs, dedicated to serving our families.
Good Friday morning, and welcome back to G's Power Hour. I never had it so good entertainment. I guess I should say good afternoon now. Thank you for being with us, and we want to thank Brendan Quinn, who was on with us the last half hour. He's the Outreach and Social Media Manager for the Center for Responsive Politics, giving us some great insight into what's coming up in the next few weeks. Someone tried to kidnap Gretchen. Gretchen Whitmer, that is, Governor Gretchen Whitmer. And some arrests were made and stuff. Just kind of another example of domestic terrorism. And we want to get a little bit more into what domestic terrorism is, and is it increasing? Is it on the rise? We have welcomed back Professor Harvey Kushner of Long Island University. Good afternoon, Dr. Kushner. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Yourself?
Doing well. Glad to have you back. So
I'm happy to be with you. Unfortunately, we always meet at these types of occasions, but anyway, it's good to be with you.
Yeah. What's going on? Someone tried to kidnap a governor.
Well,
and
you know, these types of events have gone on for years. These type of militias, these domestic groups that, some are considered terrorists and others are not. But this is really nothing new. But obviously coming at this particular time and with COVID-19 and a lot of other events, I guess there's a focus in on it. But this is really something that has existed since, the 1900s. We've had these types of events. And unfortunately, Michigan... the state of Michigan is a hotbed for these types of militias. One in particular, I think, which is they try to recruit members, is one called the Wolverine Watchmen, which is militia. They range, Gretchen, from being peaceful and just out there, having survivalist tendencies, gather and, with firearms and practice and to ones that are quite violent and can be quite dangerous to the security of certainly, in this case, the governor of the state of Michigan and to other entities.
So was Governor Whitmer in any real danger? I mean, were they just going to – was he just going to be harassed, or was this a serious effort to cause her harm?
We don't know. I mean, these things have a way of shaking out differently after a while. Obviously, the FBI, through a variety of different methods, possibly informants even within the group, were able to stop this before it happened. But obviously, they were looking to kidnap. They were looking to possibly, cause some type of a conflict within the state of Michigan or nationally. The media has reported they were looking to start a civil war. What their real beliefs are, it ranges from they probably felt that the governor, who was quite frankly very aggressive in putting in certain things in Michigan during this pandemic, was violating, as they think, the Constitution of the United States, and therefore she needed to be probably stopped because she was too aggressive. But this is interesting, Gretchen, because, you know, a lot of these groups, these militia groups, they believe in a contorted view of the Constitution, and they don't generally believe in what the federal government puts forth. So this is a hybrid type of situation. As it plays out, we find out more about the individuals involved and what their ideologies were and what their intent was. But, to put it mildly, it certainly wasn't good.
I mean, what happened to just vote her out or impeach her or something like that? I mean, or investigate her or just don't vote for her the next time? I mean,
well,
this is
the new normal. 2020, Gretchen, is going to go down as a year from the pandemic to this election. With social media, there's so many things out there that precipitate these types of events. But just to give you a little background on these types of militias, and again, Michigan is a hotbed for a variety of these different groups, but they're throughout, Gretchen, the whole United States. In all 50 states, you have these types of individuals and groups. And what brings them forward are a variety of things that they consider to be irritants. For example, the fact with this election that it might not go to their liking. That is a precipitant. In the past, we had where we had a large number of immigration problems, where we had many people coming across the border. That was an irritant to a lot of these militia groups. President Obama was elected president, a lot of them who had, quite frankly, racial tendencies, racist tendencies, were upset that we had a African-American in the White House. So it ranges from white supremacy things that cause this type of events to, and this time I think it's over the fact that the governor was quite aggressive in shutting down certain things which they thought, they have freedom to. It could be a very simple thing is the government saying, well, everybody got to wear a mask. Well, I don't want to wear a mask, and that impinges upon my freedom of expression, my amendment rights, and therefore, they take up arms. So, is it a united effort by many, many, many individuals across many platforms? Not really. This one, played out because it was against the governor, and I think the precipitant here was what she put into effect during COVID-19 and, the upcoming election.
I don't know. It just seems like there's more ignorance involved than anything,
It's ignorance, and it's also a different interpretation of things the way we know it. You could get into an intellectual discussion, Gretchen, on the Constitution and who should be appointed to the Supreme Court. Someone who is originalist, who believes the Constitution should be interpreted the way it was written, and then you have others that, go on the other side and say, no, it's a living document that changes through the times. But you're right. There is a lot of, and what's exacerbated the situation is social media. You know, years ago, communication grids were through newspapers, through possibly, you know, I can remember, I'm old enough to remember going to the movies to get news from newsreels in the movies. But, you know, that's unheard of today. You know, everybody gets their information from their phone, from Facebook, from Twitter, right, from Instagram, and everybody posts, everybody has a blog, everybody puts their ideas out there. But I wouldn't get too upset about this. Certainly, if I was the governor, I would be upset. But is it a trend? Yeah, you know, I'll tell you. I mean, I don't want to wax here, you know, so philosophical or give history lessons. But back in the 80s, these groups were growing rather significantly. And we had a couple of events that you might remember which precipitated these militias' action. We had a siege on Ruby Ridge where we had a white separatist, supremacist if you want to call him, who was holed up on a mountain, and the federal government came in and tried to take him off the mountain, and it turned out bad. We had an incident you probably remember in Waco, Texas, which ended on April 19th, 93, mm-hmm. in which the Branch Davidians were holed up, and the ATF came in and botched it up, and the FBI, and eventually including a lot of children were burned to death at Waco. And this precipitated quite a few people with anger, and that caused the 1995, April 19 bombing, I'm sure you remember, of Oklahoma City, of the Alpha Beta Mura. And that was the height of these growths of militias. Well, when the Mura building happened, and so many children were killed in that building, a lot of these people who joined these militias, for a variety of different reasons, said, you know what, I'm not going to get involved in these types of things, because look what the end result, these poor kids got killed. So we had a drop-off in people joining these types of groups that would do something like this. But then, you know what happened? We elected President Obama, and again, people who feared, well, look what's happening. There's a minority in the White House. We have all these people crossing our southern border, and so militias started to build up again. You know, so what happens here? We get this ebb and flow all the time of these individuals who have a contorted view of the Constitution, of what right is, and you know, I, the end result is. Now, I think what's precipitating some of this is the COVID-19 and restrictions that are being put in place by the state and even by the federal government, and the election that's coming up. And as you say, I think you would agree with me, this is I've never seen an election like this, you know, where we have people who are so split apart at extremes, you know. And
right.
And I believe, and I think you would agree with me, that we're better off when moving towards the center than moving towards any extreme.
Well, one thing I agree with you with definitely is when you talk about social media. And I, in a way, I don't think it's bad, because I think people should be informed. But at the same time, we get stuff so instantaneously and are expected to react to it that we're not really given enough time to logically process the information that we're given.
Absolutely.
In the good old days, so to speak, when you had a newscast and it was like 6 o'clock and then 11 o'clock and then you didn't get another one until maybe 6 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, you know, let me tell you something about that. You're so right. You know, 1999, I was asked actually by the United Nations, believe it or not, to go to Vienna and put together a panel to discuss just this, because, as you know, cable vision was starting then, and we're starting to get a 24-hour news cycle. So you needed a lot of, you know, you're in the business, you need a lot of B-roll. There was, you know, explosion of talk shows, and now look what we have on the Internet. And so you're right. You know, there's everybody has an opinion out there. I remember growing up, you turned in the news at maybe 6 o'clock, you got the news, or maybe 11 o'clock at night, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
You had time to think about it, discuss it, you know. But
today,
You know, it's insane. Look, you know, when putting together a radio show, you have to have, right, immediately have to get people, right? The B-roll is important. And, you know, it also, think about it. When you're watching something happening on television, let's say, and it's some type of event, in the background they're showing that event over and over and over and over and over again, right? And that creates an impression. And then people on their telephone. I ask the students at the university in the class, how many of you read a paper? You know how many raise their hands?
None.
Right? Gretchen, do you read the paper?
Online.
Online, exactly. Exactly. The only thing I still like to do is get the paper to do the crossword puzzle because I like to fold and hold. But other than that, I read everything online, right? So we've moved into that era. And this is why these groups can be more dangerous in a sense that, you know, everybody can become a group because you could recruit them on the Internet. And that's a big recruiting process for these types of individuals. And you know, these are small groups. They're not usually large. And they also pose a problem for law enforcement because it's much more difficult to infiltrate them. When you had a large group that held meetings, but now a lot of these groups meet online and they exchange, you know, messages that way. So it's much more difficult. But getting back to our original topic, I wouldn't get bent out of shape. I'd be concerned about this, certainly if I was concerned. But I think this is the ebb and flow what we have. What we have to worry about is that this atmosphere that we have now with the election and where people are stuck on the extremes, that I think is problematic. Is problematic, you know. And I think you see it in the tendency in what's happening in cities. You see horrific acts of vandalism, you know, destroying property, and then you see peaceful protesting. So, you know, this is the problem, right? I mean, I fear for where we're going. I think we need to move more towards a central position.
We are talking with Professor Harvey Wolf Kushner of Long Island University. This is G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. We have a few minutes left. If you want to ask him a question on the way back of the break, the number is 516-387-1944. That is 516-387-1944. G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Tim Garrison. You may know me as Timmy G. Yeah, I know. It's been 2 decades, but I want you to know I'm back in the art with you. And I've got a mix of music that can help you relax and chill out. It's smooth. It's relaxing. It's chill out jazz. The soulful mix of smooth jazz, soul, and smooth R&B. So join me every Wednesday night, 10 p.m. to midnight, on K-Ham Radio.
Are you chillin'?
Swiffer Sweeper cleans so completely, you'll never go back to your old broom again.
Now a song for Mary from a Mr. Broom.
New Swiffer Sweepers redesigned to clean corners, and it traps and locks 50% more dirt, dust, and hair than a broom. So go all the way clean. New Swiffer. Clean better or your money back. Guaranteed.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. I am your host, G. Thanks so much for being with us today. Got a full week next week. Please join us. We've got the Hair Care Hotline back. We have Tech Thursday with Burton Kelso, Friday in the Garden. We are talking about also eliminating some of the excuses you all might have for getting to the poll. Someone is helping out, and we're going to talk about that. Some other things. But next week, it's a full week, so please don't miss it. And if you have ideas that you want to suggest, hit me up on the G's Power Hour Facebook page, and we'll see what we can do to address your interests. But in the meantime, we are back here talking domestic terrorism with Professor Harvey Wolf Kushner of Long Island University. And so what makes a group that is, let's say, just voicing an opinion
about something that they don't agree with evolve to what could be considered a group that embodies domestic terrorism?
That's, you know, you asked the most important question ever on this subject. Yes. How does it go from individuals who get there and just express certain points of view, which they have a right underneath the First Amendment, and even aggressive rhetoric to actual action? That is the, you know, an old expression, a $64,000 question. You hit the nail right on the head. And I don't think any one of us who've devoted their whole life looking at this could actually give you an answer to that. What makes them go to the point where it gets into something like this? You know, it could be, you know, generally I would think if you have a smaller group, you know, someone just goes off the edge in something and then acts. You know, there are other outside events, as I said, that precipitate action. You know, they view what's happening in society, and then all of a sudden they see that, well, it's moving too far to the extreme. As I said, you know, these might have been individuals who all along harbored certain, you know, views of how government should act and what the Constitution should be about. But then through constant viewing in the media of this election and maybe a discussion about ballots not being counted accurately and the election might not go the way they wanted to, that could have pushed them off the edge, you know? It's how do you identify? How do you really identify individuals like that? And that could, look, Gretchen, it could be very well the same thing. You have individuals who then go out and shoot up a classroom. You know, at what point does it become that danger? You know what I'm saying? That's difficult. In this case, you know, it's a combination probably of a lot of things. I mean, from, you know, psychiatric reasons to ideological things to things that push someone off the edge. I think it's dangerous when we try then to label a lot of these individuals, you know, and paint them with this brush, because there's a tendency when you start to do that, that you start to paint everybody who's a member of a militia in these things. Because just to say what I mean about this, there's people who join these militias because they're survivalists. There's people who join them as they like to get together on the weekend and do these paintball exercises. There's people who join it, they want to be left alone there, you know, they want to live in a cabin up in a mountain. They want to homeschool their kids. They want to do, you know, you could begin to get all these traits. But then are these the same ones that harbor necessarily racist views or anti-Semitic views or, you know, anti-guy? You know what I'm saying? So I don't think we have an exact formula for this. We certainly don't have a scientific method, you know, to be able to pinpoint what you ask, what pushes them over the thing, you know? Because there are plenty of people, you know, who like to...
Let me ask this then. What puts them on the government's radar?
Okay, what puts them on the government's radar is if they're maybe, you know, again, this is an interesting thing. They might be stockpiling certain weapons in that. The government might look at that. They might have certain bumper stickers on their car. For example, one back, which is a famous one, is Posse Comitatus. The Posse Comitatus is the military shouldn't be involved in local law enforcement. Well, a lot of people believe that who harbor these extremes, that they have a bumper sticker on their car. Well, they might have had a bumper sticker which was anti a certain political thing, you know. Again, that's an opinion, you know. Or if they, government watches groups that, you know, probably have neo-Nazi beliefs and racist skinhead beliefs, anti-Semitic beliefs, anti-minority, and all of these things. So that puts that someone on a watch list. But, you know, you got to be very careful because, you know, we don't have enough time to go into the history of this, but, you know, in order to open up a case file on somebody or look at someone, you know, there were certain guidelines that were put into place they're called the Levy guidelines during the Carter administration, which in order for like the FBI or a federal agency to monitor someone, Gretchen, they had to have a criminal predicate, meaning you had to have something take place, an act take place, a criminal act, or you had to have reasonable belief that an act was going to be committed. Just because you didn't like what a person says, you know, their rhetoric, you just couldn't open up a case file on them, you know what I mean, and watch them and monitor them. That changed somewhat, Gretchen, with 9/11, with the USA Patriot Act, in which the government, started to then monitor certain groups. And you've noted from time to time there's been a lot of controversy from both the left and the right who have united over this and saying they didn't want the government to spy and listen into our telephone conversations, right? This has always been a controversy. And then we have also these FISA courts and all of these types of things. So, getting on the government watch list, it depends. You know, it's like this no-fly list that we have. We have a no-fly list where people, you know, if their name is put on the list, they can't get on a plane. Well, sometimes if you would have called in and complained about someone, name got on this no-fly list, they couldn't get on a plane. So, you know, that also is not a clear-cut answer to what you're asking. It's an important thing to discuss, but again, I can't give you a definitive answer as to how it gets on, you know what I mean, this intelligence agency or law enforcement agency's watch list.
So the information that the government has, is it privy to the public? Can the public get any type of access to any of it?
Well,
to
eventually,
be aware, to be informed, to protect themselves?
Well, eventually it's going to come out, yeah. Eventually now they have a case, so while it's under investigation, they're going to keep things close to their vest and not give out certain information. But then once this break, you know, from what we read in the news, and I would put the FBI and some others will eventually put out data on this case. They certainly will notify other agencies across the country, and that's another complicated issue about these individuals and their possible links to other groups. Yeah, and so that eventually, and there are plenty of groups within the government that study this, and there are also a lot of, private agencies, at universities that, hate centers and, terrorist institutes that take a look at this and collect and monitor this data. And the FBI and other government agencies put out annual reports listing these groups, discussing, you know, what they were involved in and what they would do. But again, you know, all these individuals that have been charged, they do have a right to a fair hearing and, you know, whatever the evidence is going to lead to. But I wouldn't get bent out of shape over this. I certainly would be concerned if I was the governor of Michigan. But these things exist in our society, and I don't think we can ever wipe them out. You know, unfortunately, sometimes, as I said, certain events cause this to percolate to the top. And I think right now we have, certainly in Michigan, it was the governor's aggressive takeover of people's freedoms, what they thought in the state, and they thought it was a violation of the Constitution.
It just would be nice to know, let's say, you know, who these groups are, especially if they're in extremists or hate groups involved, and not just with this particular case, but in any of the cases that are either existing currently or may surface, so that maybe, you know, there's a way to, like, not support them, like, if they have any type of financial interest that you could just stay away from and not support.
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, you know, and, you know, it's like this is not a unified group. Not all of them are racist. Not all of them are, harbor certain other beliefs. They trend that runs through them. I absolutely agree with that. You know what I'm saying? But again, I'd be very fearful. If you look at a picture of these eight, 10 individuals that they have, a lot of them had beards And so everybody who has a beard should be suspect, you know. But
yeah,
I don't mean to tamp it down that way. I do think
right.
we do have to look at it, and I do think it's, you know, responsible discussions that should take place in the media. And as you know, Gretchen, I mean, I know your show, you give both sides, but you look at turn on cable, I think you would agree with me that it's become not news, but it's become opinion. Opinion disguises news, and I think that's dangerous, you know. And I think the media, to some extent, needs to get its act together in the way it reports a lot of these things.
Dr. Kushner, I wish we had more time, but we have to run. Well, but thank you again for being with us, and hopefully you'll come back.
I certainly will. Maybe we'll get to discuss something much more pleasant the next time. Okay.
Okay, that's a plan. That's a plan.
Right.
Okay. Have a blessed day. Have a great weekend.
Bye.
And thank you all for listening. This has been G's Power Hour. I've never had it so good entertainment. Have a wonderful weekend. Be well, be safe, and please remember, all real power comes from God. Take care.